graduate students in the cooperative English test are used particularly more often with undergraduates and high school students. The only notable exception to the trend of the trends that I've noted up to this point are within the context of the math test. Non-attrited males, as a group, scored highest, and their wives scored lowest, although they were not outstandingly lower than the other groups that I've mentioned. Now, among the factors of the biographical information inventory, there are some notable trends. Two of the factors refer to the demographic variables of socioeconomic status and rural versus urban early educational background. And I know that there are many thoughts among recruiters of teachers for Alaska concerning the kinds of background that they're looking for. And one that I've heard said a number of times is that they feel that rural teachers in the lower 48 would be a good group from which to recruit. In my data, non-attrited couples or surviving couples tend to come from a relatively higher socioeconomic status and from a more urban background. So this is something that we may be able to tell recruiters at this point, that they may have to revise some opinions on this. Furthermore, there is a marked tendency for wives in the attrited group to be lower in socioeconomic status than their husbands, with the opposite trend holding for non-attrited couples. Another of the factors represents a complex of items that are easily interpretable as indicating the degree of happiness, stability, and security the individual experienced as a child. There is some evidence for intercouple complementarity within the non-attrited group. Wives in this group possess the highest scores in this factor, indicating higher levels of security, stability, what have you, while their husbands had the lowest. For some reason, complementarity on this factor seems to produce the kinds of adjustment capabilities necessary for the Alaskan village teaching scene. I've given the final factor that I'd like to discuss an interpretation that it measures a desire for distance from institutionalized or trivial social contacts. Non-attrited couples seem to desire such distance to a greater degree than do our attrited couples. This is not a very strong trend, but I think it's one that we should look at in formulating opinions of what kind of teacher is likely to survive, particularly for future recruitment purposes. Now, if I may summarize interpretively, quote unquote, there seems to be a cadre of successful couples headed by a husband who possesses a fairly well-rounded backlog of competencies combined with relatively traditional, conventional attitudes towards children and teaching. He tends to hold high interest in the teaching profession and most often grew up in a background conducive to the development of self-reliance. His wife, in addition to having a favorable pattern of competencies, possesses highly favorable attitudes toward children and teaching. Her background suggests a good deal of security and stability, which provides a complement to that of her husband. In this regard, there seems to be an essential requirement for the presence of a wife on a team who can assume a strong position of guidance and support in the teaching functions of the couple as a team. As to the future of the research that will go on in the Alaska Rural School Project, I'd like to point out a few things that I'd like to do in the future, in the near future. Future directions will include the gathering of data relevant to the direct analysis of the teacher's performance in the classroom. I'd like to remind you that an attrition criterion may or may not be related to performance in the classroom. We don't know as yet, although I have some strong feelings, but we don't know as yet the extent to which we're losing the good ones and keeping the bad ones, or vice versa. Some of the data here have some relevance to that point, but we're still in the early stages, so I really don't know. And until we can get into the classroom and make direct evaluations where we as representatives of no governing, administrative, or hiring body can hopefully be a little bit more objective in our observations, then we'll be in a position to say something about the performance of teachers and how this relates to the probability of attrition. In this context, it would be extremely relevant to consider the nature of the village itself as a variable source of stress. This would provide an additional context for the evaluation of a teacher's success. Many relevant dimensions are suggestible in this regard, including village and school size, extent of isolation from other population centers, the degree to which there is a language barrier between the pupil and his teachers. I won't mention any more, but I'm in the process of looking at the village itself as a factor in attrition, and I could editorialize a little bit here that in some cases where anecdotal comments have come out that some of the teachers that show a remarkable facility for survival on an attrition criterion are not the greatest teachers around, and in some cases these have been, and there are also teachers that seem to go completely against some of the trends that I've mentioned now. And in some cases, this has been found to be true in villages that weren't really rural. They weren't really rural villages, and hence perhaps don't have the same kind of stress conditions associated with them. So this has interested me in trying to explain some obvious discrepancies from these trends in terms of the village itself as a factor in attrition. Now, the overall objective of my research program, in conclusion, is to put information into the hands of recruiters so that they can maximize the performance of teachers in the Alaskan bush and minimize their attrition. The final criterion, however, resides not in the behavior of teachers, but in the development of a relevant program for the Alaskan native in his effort to create a place for him and his offspring in a world that simply won't leave him alone.
Thank you, Professor Orvik. We'll continue right on through the presentation of papers before we take our break so that we can keep this into consistent blocks. The next paper is to be presented by Dr. Charles Ray, and his paper is entitled Promising Practices in Programs for the Culturally Disadvantaged and Their Relevance for Northern Native People. I might comment, too, that Dr. Ray has just recently had the opportunity to observe programs in England, in Japan, in Puerto Rico, and in Canada, and has very current information to tie these elements together. Dr. Ray?
Thank you. With one eye on the clock and the other eye on Jim Hawkins, who still has a paper to present before coffee, I will depart almost completely from the paper and make some random comments drawn from the year's study observation dealing with programs of the culturally different, I don't like the term disadvantaged, but the culturally diverse, which I was privileged to observe throughout the country. I will start by saying, and perhaps Bob Rath will want to challenge this, that the ultimate objectives of the disadvantaged are essentially the same as the educational and economic objectives of any other segment in society. The intermediate goals may be different, but I would submit that black history, the teaching of Indian heritage in the schools, will serve as a means to an end, and I'm not in any way arguing against such practices, but that the overall objectives are identical. And I found throughout the world that the economic objective is a very strong factor, that this comes through loud and clear in almost every program. As has been referred to before, we start with a rather gloomy condition, and I say we, meaning those of us in schoolwork, start with the gloomy fact that the schools exert very little influence over the achievement of children. Achievement, as we know, from culturally loaded tests, which Bill Davis referred to. The Coleman Report, with which many of you are familiar, came out with the conclusion that perhaps school characteristics, including teachers, lab equipment, et cetera, might account for 10 to 20% variation in achievement. The Coleman Report did conclude that culturally disadvantaged were more dependent upon school factors than students from middle-class backgrounds. I'm even more cynical, perhaps, than the Coleman Report. I would question whether there is this much variation caused by the school. And I will use an example, and a very interesting one to me, to support this contention. In reading the Coleman Report and other reports, many of you may have noted that they will say achievement of disadvantaged groups fell well below norm, paren, with the exception of Oriental students. As one who served in Japan in 1946 and have always been a little interested in the Japanese culture, I launched upon this and used it as an excuse to visit Japan and do some study in depth, at least in partial depth, of the Japanese educational system, both in Japan and looking at the Oriental students in Chinatown and New York and in other places. By all logical, and I use the word logical in quotes, criteria, the Oriental student should not be performing well in a middle-class American society. They are visible in terms of their race. Certainly in some of the studies where 20,000 Japanese were relocated during and after World War II from the West Coast to Chicago, they were studied because this was the period of know your enemy, quote, quote. And so we have plenty of data to show us that the Japanese, with an impossible language, impossible with the idea of learning English, it is so different and so diverse, should not be achieving well in our society. But studies show very clearly that the Nisei and Issei perform extremely well, either above our medians, and even when they are average as measured by IQ or achievement tests, their performance is typically above average. And these studies, as I say, were drawn from 20,000 relocated Japanese in Chicago and many others. Why is this so? DeVos, Codhill, and many others looked at the problem. They found that while there are cultural differences, certainly the religions are different, that the cultural values are compatible. In fact, they're highly compatible. The Japanese believe in work for work's sake. Cleanliness, cooperation, punctuality, respect for parents and family. And so in many ways, as diverse as these two cultural groups may be, middle class America and Japanese, their values are compatible. Unfortunately, the Indian, Eskimo, other disadvantaged groups in the United States do not have these compatible values. I'm reminded of a statement from a clinical psychologist friend who was commenting on a very successful marriage between two extremely neurotic partners. And in explaining this, he said, yes, both the husband and the wife are very neurotic. It isn't necessary in marriage for both couples to be well adjusted. It's simply necessary that their neuroses mesh. And so in putting the Japanese values together with the middle class values, they not only mesh, but in many ways the Japanese Americans out middle class are middle class. And so what the implications of this are to me is simply that when we are dealing with groups whose socioeconomic values do not mesh, we cannot expect instant success. I think many of the criticisms of agencies working in Indian education to the effect that look how long you've been in business and the fact that we still don't have these kids reading at the fourth grade level when they're in the fourth grade are totally unfair and unjust when the complexities of the problems are viewed. And so my implication, and I would just as soon leave this until after the break for discussion rather than holding forth now, but the implications, I think, are to drastically overhaul and expand the educational endeavor. Going along with Dr. Fleshman's contention that a child's nervous system is developed in the very early stages and prenatal stages, I would submit that our educational scope would have to extend even to the prenatal care of mothers. And so the statements made about the ineffectiveness of compensatory educational programs, again, I think are very unfair. It, to me, would simply imply that we've not gone far enough. The pre-first grade programs are simply scratching the surface and perhaps serving as a sop in making us think we're doing something. But I think we have to involve the schools or agencies at stages complete from birth and even into the prenatal care of mothers before we're going to notice drastic effects. And to make such changes, which will create such havoc, and I don't think that's the right word, but will cause such drastic changes in the lives of the people being educated or dealt with, I would go along also with Bob Rath's statement that we have to decentralize and shift the decision-making from the well-meaning anthropologists, educators, and psychologists to the people themselves, because the results are going to be quite noticeable.
Thank you, Dr. Ray. The concluding paper is to be given by Mr. James Hawkins, Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Department of Commerce. His paper is titled, has been changed slightly from that in the program, to Education in Micronesia and Alaska, the Problems of Change. Mr. Hawkins.
Thank you, Frank. I'll make this short. How sweet, I'm not certain, because I will probably challenge some dearly held ideas that many of my colleagues and perhaps some in the audience have. On the surface, there would seem to be few more distinctly different places on the face of the earth than Arctic and Western Alaska and the islands of Micronesia. The islands spread across the Pacific with palm trees and sun-filled lagoons versus the dark and the cold and the empty wastes of the tundra seem to be a very great contrast. Yet I would submit that once the climatic difference is subtracted, there are some great similarities between Micronesia and Alaska. Let me tell you a little bit about Micronesia. These are the islands which the United States took from Japan during World War II. They are spread out across 3,000 miles of ocean just north of the equator, and they range north and south about 1,500 miles. Some 2,000 islands altogether, 98 of which are inhabited, a total population of slightly under 100,000 native people. These islands have at least 9 different languages, a number of different cultures. They are separated by great distances of ocean, which make communication and transportation difficult. They depend chiefly upon the resources of their area for their living, with a slight cash economy, at least in the outer island areas, derived from the preparation and sale of copra. They participate very little in a money economy in most of the islands. They come to school not speaking English, and the children come from a highly integrated and well-defined social structure in almost all instances. I have described the Pacific Islands, but I have also, those of you who have been in Alaska, described some aspects of Alaska, because here too you have the great distances which make communication and transportation difficult. You have diverse linguistic and cultural groups, and you have people who are on the fringes of American economy and American government, both of which are administered by a non-native administration for a great many of their wants. In going to the Pacific Islands, while being struck initially with this similarity between Alaska and the islands, I discovered some differences when it came to the educational system. And I think these differences are important in terms of trying to understand the factors that make for success in an educational system. Let me tell you that in Micronesia, the system for a long time and still is Micronesianized. The average teacher in the average classroom is a Micronesian teacher, not an American teacher. Now, his qualifications by American standards may be very low. He may not have graduated from high school. He probably did not attend college. He has had, for the most part, some training, either in his home district or in a teacher training institute operated in the Trust Territory, so that he is prepared to some degree for his job of teaching. The contrast, of course, is quite clear that such is not the case in Alaska. Alaska natives do not man the classrooms for the most part, although there is an increasing number coming in as teachers. And there is not much in the way of materials at the present time in Alaskan classrooms about Alaska. In Micronesia, not because this was planned this way, interestingly enough, but because of neglect, the local materials were in the local languages, prepared usually by the local teacher with flimsy equipment, goodness knows, but orthographies did exist for every district and every language. Materials do exist for every language in Micronesia, and newspapers and other publications are published in Micronesia in the local languages. There is a very great reliance upon the local language. Another difference was that students who did go on to high school, and very few did for many, many years, and then who had the opportunity to go on to the university, returned to Micronesia to assume positions of importance in Micronesia. Doctors, I should say perhaps physicians, went to the Fiji School of Medicine for a 5-year medical training course and came back and operated the hospitals, directed the medical services in most of the districts. People who had gone to the University of Hawaii and came back to assume administrative positions were quite prominent. And as a result, the models upon which the children could view their own future in terms of being Micronesian and assuming to go into important positions in the government or in their local economy were quite prevalent. And such is not the case, I submit, in most of rural Alaska. The models are not in the villages, and very few of the children have an opportunity to visit, to see, and talk to successful Eskimos, successful Indians, and successful Aleuts. I would like to suggest two specifics which have come out of my experience in Micronesia that might be helpful for Alaska. Number one, the fundamental aspect of education for all of us is the ability to communicate ideas. If we are walled off from this ability to communicate by any one of a number of factors, including that of speaking a different language than the majority culture, then we are hopelessly hampered from achieving our potential as a human being. I do not believe that yet Alaska and Micronesia has only begun to develop a comprehensive and effective system of teaching English as a second language. We do not send teachers into the bush who know how to teach English as a second language. The teachers do not know, for the most part, the language of the people with whom they are working. And a truly effective system of teaching English as a second language is as essential for Alaska as it is for Micronesia. This is beginning to develop in Micronesia with the help of the Peace Corps and with the help of the South Pacific Commission. And we are finding increasingly that native people make excellent teachers of English as a second language, better even than Americans who know the language. The second recommendation I would like to make follows directly on the heels of Dr. Rath's recommendation, and that is to get control of the educational system into the hands of local people. Increasingly, I am convinced that people, even though not having what you and I might term a higher education, are capable of making the decisions, the right decisions, when it comes to the education of their children. Some experiments in Micronesia have convinced me that this is the case, and I think that until we reinforce the educational effort in western and northern Alaska with control of the educational system in the hands of the people whom it serves, we will have only a middling degree of success in really involving the people of Alaska in making the decisions and pushing their children to the point where an education becomes an important part of their plan for the future.
Thank you, Mr. Hawkins, and all members of the symposium. We will adjourn for approximately 20 to 30 minutes for coffee, reconvene here shortly after 11, at which time the presenters of papers will be available for questions and further comments. There are ushers available to take questions as well as those that care to leave them off at the desk. The usher, here's an usher here. She'll be glad to collect your questions. Until a short time after 11.
Start the thing before it's over. No,
bell should be answered.
They really should. I didn't write. Sat through all this.
Somebody wrote three.
We'll call the session back to order and proceed with the answers to a number of questions that have been generated by the presentations. However, before we begin, I've been asked to announce that bus schedules of the bus from Moore Hall to the International Airport are available, may be picked up, and this schedule will accommodate the times from 10 in the morning all the way through late in the evening for those of you that need transportation on Wednesday to the, or on Thursday to the airport. If you need transportation on Wednesday, to contact the information desk at Moore Hall. But here is a published schedule of buses to the airport. We have reviewed a number of the questions and distributed them according to the persons that you have requested to answer them. Since it's obvious there isn't enough time to answer all of the questions, each member of the panel has been asked to select the question that appears the most pertinent or relevant to his presentation, or maybe the one that will generate the most discussion or interest. We'll proceed one at a time in this manner. And then if our total time allows, go back and start picking it up on second questions. This way we'll get an equal distribution as far as the interests of those of you in the audience. I would like to respond, however, to the first one, since it is not addressed to anyone in particular. The question, why not at least one Alaska Native teacher or educator on this panel? And since this seems to be the popular question of the conference, I think there is a very legitimate answer, although it isn't one that satisfies anyone at all. It doesn't satisfy those of us that are here, but the question almost tends to put people on the defensive that happen to be in a position where they have developed some points of view because of their scientific observations or their investigations, and to the point that possibly they should not reveal these findings because they had the misfortune to not be included in this group that has come to be categorized as Alaska Natives. Might I ask, maybe there are. Native, it seems, is supposed to be a cultural context, not racial. It's possible that some of the people here do have this background, for one. So I think there's been a tendency, and an unfortunate tendency, to judge this on the basis of racial characteristic rather than cultural heritage. We're talking about cultural heritage, and I would hate to speak for the cultural heritage of all the people on this panel. I know I don't want to speak for the genetic makeup of myself. However, this is not really the answer. The answer, I think, is simply why 10 or 20 years ago were few institutions offering courses in astrophysics? Why 30 years ago were few institutions having panels on the impact of nuclear fission? Why in the early 20s were there very few courses in aerodynamics? I think we're experiencing a process of social evolution tied to scientific evolution, and we would hope very much that the conferences of this nature a few years hence will be when issues of this nature that involve cross-culturalism come to the fore, that there will be so many people with this particular genetic background, if this is what's sought, I'm not sure, but if this is what's sought, that there will be such a sufficient number of these people that we, in turn, will be able to sit in the back and say, this is cross-culturalism. Why have not some of us from the outside been allowed to speak? Starting on the extreme left, Dr. Ray, if you would respond to the question that you've selected, please.
Yes. I have a question that is as follows. It says, are you suggesting that the womb-to-tomb concept of education be westernized or that it should be native-based? The question is raised by your reference to similar cultural goals of Japanese-American and middle-class American people. Apparently, the cultural values of the native Alaskan and the Western European or American middle class are less compatible, therefore, which is taught or both. I'm pleased to receive this question because it does allow me to elaborate just a little. I dealt hastily with my concluding recommendation in the paper, and that is that these decisions should not be made such as by those of us on the panel. It ties in with Dr. Rath's recommendation and that of other members of the panel that the decision as to how Western should the Alaskan Eskimo and Indian be should only be made by the Alaskan Eskimo or Indian, which gets into your decentralization, your shift of decision-making to the groups involved. I would speculate, however, that since the economic theme ran through virtually all the studies I came into contact with, that the decision would well be that the Alaskan Indian or Eskimo would have to be sufficiently familiar with Western values and cultures to compete in this society. I don't think we're going to restructure our society, and therefore I do believe that the decision will probably be that this education would allow the freedom of choice on the part of the Indian or Eskimo so that he could choose the values he would accept and those he would reject. Certainly members of our younger generation who are not considered in the culturally disadvantaged or minority category have rejected our middle class value of material acquisition. So it may well be that the native groups would want to say, this we don't want to buy, but I believe this education from womb to tomb, as stated in the question, would have to provide the option so that the persons themselves could make the choice or the groups could make the choice.
Thank you, Dr. Ray. Dr. Fleshman, would the first question that you've selected to respond to?
I've received quite a few that are of different subjects and be happy to answer any of these personally that we don't get to. Two of them have to do with nutrition. I'll not read the question but try to cover it in just a short discussion. One of them dealt with what is the PHS doing to educate the native about the value of a balanced diet, health and sanitation, and how effective has this been, and the other regards any quantitative data regarding nutrition. One of our problems in being quantitative is a lack of good background data that is continuous. I'd refer anyone interested to the published work of Christine Heller of the Arctic Health Research Center here on the campus, and their librarian can provide this. The problem with this, it's at one point in time, and we haven't been able to have any continuous studies in the same location to document the change in diet. All this has been observations of people in the area and is not quantitative. The program of education, of health education, is a basic integral part of the public health nurse. And the public health nurses have been all work for the Department of Health of the state of Alaska and work in coordination with our program in the field. They are itinerant nurses. They are not able to visit the villages as frequently as possible, and many areas unfortunately go uncovered because of lack of funds to hire enough nurses or enough helpers for them. The part of their program on visiting the villages is to work with families, particularly centering their work around the mother and young children, to educate toward the utilization of a proper diet with the food resources they have. I think one of the missed opportunities is to continue this on in a meaningful way in the school. I think the school lunch program could do a lot more than feed the children. I think that it should be an educational experience, and I think that I've been in a lot of schools and I've seen very few children involved in the preparation of the school lunches, and would hope that this could come about. Quite a few years ago, aides in the village were picked to, began to help the public health nurse in her work. And about 15 years ago, they also began to be tied toward the field hospital and to communicate health problems directly over the radio. And over the years, this has evolved into a pretty definite position. And in the past year or so, a formal training program for these local health aides has evolved through the Public Health Service. These mostly are women, some men, are now involved or approaching the second level of training, of formalized training, of which a great part is in providing nutritional and basic health education back to their people. We're very happy that these are now recognized and funded positions. This has been voluntary in the village. These have been mothers and housewives who have done this. They're not paid equal to their service, but in this way we've seen a definite improvement in health. It gives me an opportunity to answer one of the other questions. What are we doing to lessen the impact of hospitalization and illness? What we've seen happen in the last 2 years has been a regression of the level at which illness is detected and treated. First of all, not as many children are getting ill. They're cared for better in the prenatal area, in the prenatal stage, and in early infancy. Those who become ill are recognized sooner and are treated at home via contact through the radio and the health aid and don't even have to come to the hospital. Those that do come to the hospital come in better shape and earlier so that they can be treated at the field hospital, which is close to home. And we've had a reduction in the pediatric service in Anchorage, which is a referral center, from 90 beds down to 45 beds. The average length of stay has decreased from a month and a half down to 2 weeks. And although we are servicing more patients, they are coming in and getting home again. So these things we think will have a very significant effect.
Dr. Rath, you've selected one.
The question is, one of your recommendations referred to coordination of agencies, and I didn't talk about it. My intent here is that I would recommend that all resources for a community from all those outside agencies, including school, health, etc., should be coordinated by the government of that community, not by a bureaucratic structure. If, as this panel seems to indicate, education cannot be improved by education alone, it will take a coordination with health and nutrition and housing and, you know, on down the line. The only way that I see that coordination is possible is through the local government.
Mr. Hawkins?
One of the questions which has been passed to me in writing is, do you believe that non-native Alaskans ought to have Eskimo or Indian as a second language in their schools? I think this might be an excellent idea, although I think since English is the dominant language and the language of communication within Alaska and between Alaskans, both native and non-native, that Eskimo or Indian could probably only assume the importance of French or German as a foreign language. But if credit could be given for it in our high schools, in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and other places, it might encourage more children to communicate on more fundamental levels within Alaska. One other question which I was asked verbally, you know, what would you do specifically? And I understand that specifically in terms of getting some English as a second language into the schools, and I understand that some work is beginning to be done here now at the university on this, I would certainly feel that as a start, as a very specific and concrete start, that working through a center here at the university, a group of selected Native people could be brought in on a training program, a year's training program, or however long it might take. I would assume that it probably would not take longer than a year to turn them, if they had a basic command of the English language and a basic command of education through high school, I think that they could be turned into effective teachers of English as a second language in their home communities within a year. Our experience in the Trust Territory has shown that this can be done, actually in periods of time shorter than a year. And in this way, I think you could begin to get a native presence in our schools. We could start with 15 the first year and try it out on an experimental basis. This doesn't cost much money, and it could be an exceedingly effective way in which to work to get native faces in the classrooms in our outlying schools. And I would think that either the state, the Commissioner of Education, or the Bureau of Indian Affairs Area Director could probably effect this change with a minimal amount of bureaucratic red tape over the next year or so. This was one specific suggestion which I think could be worked without a great deal of money involved.
I might comment just a little bit additionally to this, that probably of the three or four programs that are currently being discussed by people in the State Department of Education and the university on a cooperative basis to augment and change the educational programs, the issue of native teacher aides, or actually aides, is almost becoming an unfortunate term, because some people have said this puts people in a secondary status when it really isn't the intention at all. But a second person in the classroom with the advantage of knowing the language and the culture of the children is probably the next big step that will be taken by the state. We've been asked to prepare teacher training programs that will enable these people to go into the villages, or that come out of the villages, come here for specific teacher training, and then go back into the village, but not necessarily at the baccalaureate level as yet. If, on the other hand, these people found that the university setting was to their liking and wanted to continue pursue preparation for formal teacher certification, this would be the next step in line for them. But we can expect to see this development, I believe, on a rather broad scale in the next year or two. Jim?
This is actually a two-part question. There's a question and a comment. The question part is, am I suggesting that attrition rate is relevant to performance in any way? Relevant, yes. Related, I don't know. It's relevant insofar as we want to make sure that that we're not, as I said before, we're not keeping what we would agree to be a poor teacher and getting rid of or losing one that we might agree to be a very good teacher. The common part of this was that perhaps it is better to have a teacher turnover each year of great teachers than to have mediocre or poor teachers remain for many years. I applaud that. I think that if you were asking me, do I agree with this, how could I disagree? I think the whole question, getting back to performance, and what constitutes a great teacher or a mediocre teacher or a poor teacher, is of course an obvious question that we have to face. There's no small amount of information based on the Lower 48 as to what constitutes a good teacher. What we have to do is sift for our purposes what are the relevant dimensions for calling a good teacher in the Lower 48 a good teacher in the Alaskan Bush. And I think such dimensions that we might look at are the kinds of classroom atmosphere that the teacher creates. And this wouldn't matter whether he's a non-native teacher or whether he is a native teacher, whether it's whether somebody's speaking in English and teaching in English or teaching English as a second language. If jotting down a few of these dimensions might allow you to either agree or disagree with me, at least form some of your own opinions and give you some general thoughts on this. I think by classroom atmosphere, I would look at such things as the degree to which the teacher relies on punitiveness as a way of control in the classroom, the degree to which the teacher creates a democratic atmosphere in the classroom, the degree to which the teacher holds a concept of I am the faucet and you are the sponge over his children in the classroom, the use of unexplained rules in the classroom, the amount of regimentation the teacher engages in. These are things that are observable by outsiders. How much, to what extent does a teacher use the classroom as a captive forum for the meeting of his own defensive needs? To what extent does the teacher allow the student to express and inquire? To what extent does the student become the locus of his own understanding and of his own decision making, as opposed to the teacher saying, I know what the decisions are, I know what the right alternatives are, and you keep asking questions until you find them? These are things that have been investigated in contexts outside of Alaska, but I think they're extremely relevant kinds of dimensions, and this list is by no means exhaustive of all the dimensions we could look at. But I think we've got to start looking along these lines so that we'll be prepared to meet the cross-cultural demands that we've been raised here on this panel, that we need more native teachers. Well, it's going to be a long time, I fear, before we will have a system that is primarily taught by natives, and particularly native-speaking people. And I think that looking at the trend so far, we've been getting 50 new teachers in the Alaska Rural School Project alone. This doesn't represent the whole new input to the state every year, meaning the state and the BIA. It is maybe half of the input of new teachers, and the new teachers represent vacancies of perhaps one-third of all the available teaching positions. So we're talking about a very large body that we either want to bury or exhume or cremate or something. But it represents a very large corporeal being that is going to be around for a long time. And I think it's incumbent upon us, I feel incumbent upon me to engage in the kind of research that will allow us to maximize the life of the body and resuscitate it.
Thank you, Jim. Dr. Davis?
I got the same kind of question that Jim did. It's a half commentary and half question. Although in the reverse order, this of his came commentary first and then question. The commentary is that it seems that you were documenting and suggesting that the school is failing rather than the student. That's true. But I think I should say that I was trying to document and suggest that both were failing. That is, not just the school, but also the student. The question is, do you have any suggestions as to how to change the school setting to eliminate its ability to create underachievers or dumb Indians? And I'm very glad you asked that question, since I do. First of all, I would only repeat what has been said before, and that is that you regionalize and you decentralize. You give effective control of the schools to people. Now, I am, however, moved to comment that this is easier said than done, because what we're talking about is giving to the peoples themselves the ability to hire and fire the teachers, to determine the curricular content, to allow them to make mistakes, which at the present time we prevent them from the luxury of having, because we prefer to make the mistakes for them, and that you simply do not do this and expect it to work. That is to say, during coffee break, I was lobbying with Lowell Thomas on this very point to ask him to introduce some legislation, so maybe we could do this, that is, give effective control. But you don't just pass a law and say to the people here, you run the schools now. You must provide them with supportive services. You must do the sorts of things which will allow them to be successful. You help them to come to learn how to operate a school board. So you make yourselves available. But I might indicate that there is a large body of resistance to this kind of thing. And it comes not only from the traditional bureaucracies they're required to give up their fiefdoms. It comes from the people on the firing line. Our experience with the Bush teachers that we had AMU this summer was that when we suggested that perhaps there should be a local school board that ran their school, this was the one suggestion that got them more uptight than anything else, because they suddenly realized that we were talking about the fact that they would be working for the council that they can't get along with, for the townspeople who are the source of their difficulties, and they were very resistant to this. Not only that, but I suspect that the legislature would, in fact, be resistant to this if there weren't built-in controls. And yet this seems to be the era of block grants and revenue sharing, so that it really is quite possible that there could be fiscal plans worked out that would allow regionalization and decentralization. But on the other hand, there's an inherent danger, because if you stop to think about it for a moment, one of the institutions of which we are most proud in this country is our public education system, which is the bastion of local control and must be protected at all points against assaults from the federal government and from any kind of governmental intrusion. Therefore, we are all very happy because we have our local school boards which are responsive to our local needs. And I would suggest that if you examine the public education system of this country, you would find that it is the most conformist, uniform, consistent, unvarying, non-diverse institution that we have, and it couldn't be more monolithic if it were administered by a central bureau in Washington. So that the concept of local control, which we guard so greatly in our schools, does not necessarily ensure that all of these other good things are going to follow. So just by giving the control to the schools, we're not going to solve this problem.